Escape Pod 31. December 8, 2005. Today's story, Robots and Falling Hearts, by Tim Pratt and Greg Van Niekerk.
Hi, welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. So, it's the Christmas season now, and everybody's running around in a mad race to buy each other things, because that's what we're expected to do. This is probably going to sound really humbuggish, and I don't mean it that way, but I find myself feeling more and more detached each year from the whole gift process. Both the giving and the getting. It is entertaining, and it's fun to be surprised by stuff I never expected, but the further I get from childhood, the less it strikes me as a deep emotional experience. Maybe I'm just too high on the privilege chain, but most of the people I know, if there's something they'd like, they have the ability to buy it themselves. I know I can most of the time, and it seems weird to put off buying something for a few months because there's a chance that someone else might invest their resources in it for me instead. It's a weird economy. I much prefer to tell people how I feel about them by, well, telling them how I feel about them. But that's the perspective of a jaded adult. And even now, I understand when gifts matter the most, when you can't buy them yourself, and most of all, when you're a child. I think charity and children are really where Christmas connects, where I can still get emotional about it. Here's where I'm going with this. Most of you are, I'm sure, familiar with the webcomic Penny Arcade. It's basically ground zero of the video game culture. A couple of years ago, they started up a charity called Child's Play, which has the goal of providing toys and games for sick children in hospitals. The first year, it was one hospital in Seattle. This year, it's 21 hospitals in three countries, and they've already raised over $250,000. They're doing it, they say, to make a statement against people who want to paint video gamers as violent, antisocial nutballs. This is their way of saying, look, gamers can come together and achieve great things. Not to numb children to the world, but to make them smile. Ultimately, I don't think it matters why they're doing it. That they are doing it is absolute good. I can connect with this. It makes me emotional to think about being a part of it. It gives me joy, far more than new golf balls for my dad. I'm going to support Child's Play this year, and I think you should too if you have the means. And if you don't have the means, there's a way you can help me support them, but I'll cover that in the administrivia after the story. Said story this week is Robots and Falling Hearts by two repeat Escape Pod contributors, Greg Van Niekerk and Tim Pratt. Greg should be known to all of you for the several flash pieces, sorry, story grenades, he's given us. Greg's been published many, many times in FNSF, Asimov's, Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, etc. His Santa story last year, in the late December, was nominated for the Nebula Award. He lives in Tempe, Arizona, and he's a very hoopy fruit. Tim Pratt is also a Nebula-nominated writer and a Riesling Award-winning poet, as well as an editor and reviewer for Locus. He's been heard on Escape Pod twice, including the only poem we've run. He lives in Oakland, California, and he's newly wed to another Escape Pod author, Heather Shaw. This is getting really cozy here. Tim's first novel, The Strange Adventures of Ranger Girl, came out from Bantam Spectra a couple of weeks ago. It's strange, it's adventurous, and it's got hot girl-on-range action. Those are our authors. This collaboration between them came out in Realms of Fantasy in October this year, and the only word I have for it is extraordinary. I think you'll hear what I mean. The story is read for us by Alex Wilson of the website Telltale Weekly. Alex is doing a great thing over there, building a solid audiobook library with a mixture of free and dirt-cheap content. Whether you're looking for a current SF or classics or the U.S. Constitution, Telltale Weekly has a bit of everything. Alex is a great reader, and we're proud to have him on the Escape Pod team. So, without further ado, close your eyes and breathe deep. It's parable time.
Robots and Falling Hearts by Tim Pratt and Greg Van Niekerk. Down in their innermost hearts, people expect the occasional rain of frogs or blood, people bursting into spontaneous flames, animals speaking in human tongues. Such things are part of our shared heritage, the mysteries of human history, and while they might confound and frighten us, deep down they don't feel wrong. But no one knew quite how to react to the recent plague of robots. I went to Los Angeles because it was supposed to be the worst there, maybe even the place where the plague started, robots going unnoticed for a long time because of Hollywood. For a long time, people assumed the robots were props or publicity stunts or refugees from public access television junkyard wars, until it became obvious that they were something more. My first day in the city, I sat at a table outside Pete's in Brentwood, sipping a caramel apple cider, watching the beautiful people walk by. This was much nicer than crouching on an exposed frozen mountainside, sipping barley tea flavored with rancid yak butter, though that experience had its charms, too. Half an hour after I sat down, I saw my first L.A. robot crouched on top of a passing BMW. The robot was like a starfish made of articulated metal, all chrome except for brass joints, and it clung to the car's roof rack, a whip antenna rising up from the center of its body. I wondered if the driver knew about his robotic passenger. I threw away my cup and went walking, ostensibly window shopping, but really keeping my eye open for more robotic manifestations. I paused to tie a loose shoelace, and a squat robot, like a dirty white trash can on tank treads, trundled out of an alley toward me. A red light on top of its dome-like top blinked erratically. It said in a high-pitched voice, A small panel slid open in its front, and a pole with a cup on the end telescoped out. There were a few coins in the cup, mostly pennies and nickels, and the robot jingled the cup significantly. "Take me to your leader," I said, wishing it could be that simple, knowing that things are never that simple. The robot beeped at me and jingled its cup harder, the coins rattling. "It won't go away unless you give it some change," said a woman standing on the corner. It followed me all the way to work one day and hung around outside the door like a dog for hours. "Yeah," I said, taking a good look at her. She wasn't uncommonly pretty, but I'd been on assignment in the Himalayas for several months previous, and she was the first woman who'd spoken to me in seasons. "Has it been around here long?" She shrugged. "I guess. Even a penny will get rid of it." I looked down at the robot. "Piss off," I said, enunciating clearly, just to see what it would do. A low grinding noise came from deep inside the robot's squat body, and I took a step back, expecting something nasty to happen. Instead, it just said, "Danger, danger," and flailed its single arm around wildly for a moment, coming dangerously close to spilling its coins. I gave in and dropped a quarter into its cup. The robot beeped contentedly and rolled away. "See," the woman said. "Can I ask you a question?" I said. "Do you remember the first time you saw a robot here in the city?" "Sure," she said. "Everybody remembers that." But then the light changed and she started across the street. I said, going after her. "If I could just have a moment." She continued walking, and with a half glance over her shoulder, she reached into her purse and came out with a jangling cluster of keys attached to a matte black cylinder. Pepper spray, I figured, or maybe a taser. "I'm a student," I said, pulling up even with her. I'm a student, and I'm doing research on the robot plague, and if I could interview you, it would only take a few minutes. Her thumb moved over a little red button on the top of her keychain, and when we reached the curb, she turned and looked me up and down. As she performed a threat assessment on me, I decided that in her own way, she really was rather attractive. I liked the freckles sprinkling her round cheeks, and despite the hard set to her jaw, her pale lips formed pleasing, sensuous curves. Her hands were slender but strong, thick-veined with blunt, unpainted fingernails, hands built for more than office work. The sun caught coppery highlights in her brown hair, which she wore pulled back into a tight ponytail, leaving just a few free strands that floated with liquid grace in the slight breeze. After a moment, her shoulders relaxed a little, and she started holding the keychain the way one holds a keychain, instead of the way one holds an anti-creep weapon. "If you want to know about the robots," she said, "you should be talking to City Hall or the cops or the Brainiacs at Caltech. I don't even subscribe to the newspaper. I just live here." I was about to tell her that I didn't want so-called expert opinions, that I'd read all the official reports and already knew what the politicians and pundits and consultants had to say, that what I really needed, if I were going to get to the bottom of this thing, was the word on the street, and that she smelled of oranges and shampoo, and that after spending weeks on the edge of a frozen rock in a tent that smelled of sweat and farts and men, I really wanted to buy her lunch. But a mechanical voice cut me off before I could even get two or three words out.
"Wizmo!"
"Oh, great," the woman said. "Now it's Wizmo." She grabbed my wrist and started tugging me down the sidewalk.
"Wizmo!"
She dragged me beneath an overpass behind a broad concrete support pillar. As the vast clattering grew louder, I started to speak, and she covered my mouth with her hand. It was all I could do not to kiss her palm. From behind the pillar, we watched as Wizmo zoomed by. His original shape was wholly obscured by the spoilers, stick-on rear-view mirrors, handlebars, small plastic Buddhas, and other assorted junk bristling from his frame, all of it banging together, reminding me of certain mountain ceremonies useful in dispelling ghosts and unfriendly wildlife. When Wizmo was out of sight, she took her hand from my mouth. "He used to be a pretty boring robot," she said. "He looked like a gas-powered generator on wheels. But then the neighborhood kids started sticking bumper stickers on him, and someone else attached a bicycle horn and some reflectors, and it went on from there. Now he chases people until they add something to his chassis. Wizmo knocked down a guy once, but he wasn't hurt too badly." I thought of Master Tenzin's temple, which he encouraged visitors to embellish with carvings and drawings and the occasional glob of chewing gum, and his story of the group of explorers who visited his first temple 40 years before. When asked to add their own touches to that temple, the drunken explorers burned the building down. After the flames died, Master Tenzin stood in the midst of the ashes, turning slowly around, and then knelt and drew a single jagged line in the soot. The explorers, who'd expected to break the master's preternatural calm, jeered at him and then went on their way. They died in an avalanche that afternoon, but when I drew the obvious conclusion that Master Tenzin's drawing had somehow contributed to that snowy death, he merely shook his head sadly, as if I'd missed the point. "You were going to tell me about the first time you saw the robots," I said. We were still standing very close together. Getting back to the business at hand seemed the wisest course. She stepped away, out of arm's reach. "No, you asked me to. I told you to ask people who actually know something." I nodded. I sighed. "See," I said, "see, the thing is, and this isn't something that just anyone knows, but, well, look, where do you think the robots come from?" She shrugged. "I guess it's just a bunch of people building them for fun, setting them loose all over the world. Or maybe it's like a government experiment in artificial intelligence. They build a bunch of robots and release them to see if they can learn. Who knows?" "Nobody knows," I said, "but everyone began from the assumption that the robots were built, just like you did. The thing is, the scientists have broken a lot of these robots open. They've checked out the mechanisms, and these robots shouldn't work at all. There's machinery inside them, circuit boards and wires and even the occasional vacuum tube, but none of it's connected in a way that makes sense. These things, they're more like sculptures of robots than real robots, and there it is, inarguably. They work. They move, they interact, they learn. Some of them steal, some of them harass, some of them save children from burning buildings, some of them gouge potholes in the roadways, and some of them repair broken traffic lights. They do all these things when they shouldn't be able to do anything at all." She blinked. I realized I'd been shouting. I get excited. I haven't heard anything like that, she said, about how they shouldn't work. Yeah, well, I said, it's not something the officials are spreading around. I'm only telling you because I want your help. You were here when it started, the first time the robots showed up in the first place. We thought it was a publicity thing for some sci-fi movie, she said. So, tell me about it. She shook her head. Who are you? How do you know that the scientists are keeping secrets? What exactly are you trying to find out? You said you're a student? Sort of a student. I thought about how to explain my job, my calling, and what I hope to find out about the plague of robots. Random words and images appeared in my mind. A childhood fascination with the Fiji mermaid, that disastrous internship with the Society for Fortean Studies, cryptophenomenology, the corporate-sponsored codification of transcendental experiences, how I'd gone to the Himalayas to investigate a levitating monk and instead met Master Tenzin. Ah, but Master Tenzin had taught me how to respond in such situations when the very complex needed to be communicated in a succinct and interesting way. I better tell you a parable, I said. You know, no offense, but I'm not really one of those yoga tofu people. Yoga's good for your back, I said absently, sorting through my days spent at the feet of Master Tenzin. Should I tell her of the ram and the shepherd, of the king and the bamboo sliver, of the fat man and the paper chair? No. Of all the lessons I took from the cold mountains, there seemed only one that might help her understand why I had come here, to this vast puzzle box of a city, to learn about the robots and thus peel back the secrets of the world. So I told her this. There was a man who sat at the edge of the market, surrounded by frogs of all manner. Frogs blue as sapphire, frogs red as blood, frogs the size of a pea, frogs large as dogs, frogs bewinged, frogs with teeth, frogs with as many legs as a spider. Each day he squatted in the dust amidst a chorus of croaks and wrote in tiny script on a crowded piece of parchment. It was said that the parchment listed and described every kind of frog on earth, and that when the last frog was properly cataloged, the old man would die. One morning, a boy came to the man, offering for sale a frog he had found by the river with eyes on stalks like a snail. After some negotiation, the frogman gave the boy some few coins, a very fair trade, and yet the boy remained. "Why do you linger?" asked the frogman of the boy. "Is there something more you wanted?" "Are you not going to list my frog?" the boy asked. The frogman showed the boy a corner near the upper edge of the parchment, where the ink was old and faded. The writing described a frog with eyes like a snail's, and also a little boy who found a frog by a stagnant green river and brought the frog to an old man who spent his days scribbling in the market, surrounded by baskets and bamboo, cages containing frogs. "But of course, I have already written of this," the old man said. "Long ago, otherwise, how would there have been a frog for you to find?" And he told the boy to go home and to write of his own frogs, so that when he became an old man, there would still be frogs awaiting young boys by the river. The woman smirked and cocked her head, and I entertained the notion that there was a remote possibility she found me cute. "Okay," she said, "I'll be your grasshopper. So the little boy is you, and the frogs are the robots, and the old man expresses the indistinguishable natures of cause and effect. Yeah, did I get it right?" Her eyes were the color of iced tea in the sun.
"No, you did not get it right."
We both spun toward the voice at our backs. A 6-foot-tall robot, like a barber pole mounted on a single bicycle wheel, rolled toward us, spinning a ribbon of silver and gold and bronze. Here and there it was decked out with chrome and leather trim, like the back seat of a car in American Graffiti, and it exuded the smells of clean oil and menthol. its head a polished globe as brilliant as a shaving mirror, extended towards us on a scissor's arm, and when I looked into it, I felt the sidewalk go a little sideways beneath my feet, for it wasn't my face I saw reflected in the robot's head. A battered face with a bulbous nose, red eyes, and a split lip peered out at me, distorted by the curved nature of the sphere. Upon closer inspection, I realized that it was my face, but a horribly damaged, nearly unrecognizable version of it, beaten to a pulp. Excitement gathered in the pit of my stomach. There was something here, something about the flesh as grass, something about the futility of desire and earthly things. It had occurred to me more than once, many times, in fact it was the closest thing I had to a hypothesis at this point, that the robots were bodhisattvas for a new age, alien saints, holy fools, and this strange, bright, sleek thing before me was a fucking doombot, the woman said wearily. The robot swung its sphere toward her, and I caught a glimpse of the shifting face in the sphere. Now it was her face, hideously disfigured, and I looked away, far more disturbed by the thought of her flesh ravaged than I'd been at the sight of my own.
You got it wrong,
the Doombot said, and made a snorting noise, mechanical but still full of disdain. It mimicked her viciously, perfectly.
The little boy is you, and the frogs are the robots, and the old man expresses the indistinguishable natures of cause and effect. Bah, parables aren't metaphors. They don't map exactly to a given situation. They provide insight. If that's what you got out of a parable, I despair to think of what you do with a koan.
It's no use talking to this Doombot, she said. All it ever does is bitch and belittle. But it seems to be conscious, I said. It's speaking in complete sentences. I bet I could learn a lot from it. It's not like the others I've seen. You'd be wasting your time. The Doombot was one of the first robots to show up here. It came the first day, and since it talked, everyone thought it was the spokesman or the king or something. The mayor's task force spent hours and hours interviewing it and never got it to talk sense or talk about its origins or anything. It just complained and insulted them. Eventually they gave up and let it go. Now it's a free-range doomsayer. The Doombot extended its sphere toward her, and she swung at it irritably with her purse.
30 pounds of flax,
the Doombot muttered, jerking its head back. The sphere retracted, the face in its glass pixelating into nonsense. The barber pole swirl started turning more quickly, and I began thinking about the endless spiral of life, a stairway to the infinite. Then I cocked my head and frowned at the woman. How do you know what the mayor's task force thought? I thought you didn't even read the papers. She sighed and looked away. Because I used to be part of the task force. My part didn't last long. I don't like to talk about it. This was unreal. She'd had close, intimate contact with the first robots, had at the very least been fully briefed on the events of the day of their arrival. What a resource! I was, for a moment, ashamed for thinking of her in such utilitarian terms, but I did have a mission to fulfill. What was your position on the task force? I asked. Her face was still turned away from me, and the absence of her gaze made me feel like winter. The Doombot thrust its sphere between our heads.
Stupid, stupid,
it said, voice flat with disgust.
I'll tell you what her position was.
The woman lashed out at the sphere, striking it with the flat of her hand, making it swing away at the end of its scissors arm and slam into the concrete pillar where the glass shattered, little slivers of prismatic glass raining down. Half demolished, the remaining part of the sphere looked like a cup with jagged edges. I leaned over, suddenly sure there was something inside the sphere, some revelation, some... There was a small, green frog inside. I think it looked back at me when I looked at it. It was hard to tell because its eyes were on stalks, moving independently, like a snail's. Shit, the woman said. She hadn't seen the frog yet. I didn't mean to do that. The sphere was always unbreakable before. Believe me, people try to break it all the time. The woman poked the gleaming shards of the Doombot's head with her toe. While she was preoccupied, I bent down and enclosed the frog in my cupped hands. Its skin was cool and soothing against my palms. "Tell me," I said, "what did you do on the investigatory commission? What was your job?" Her mouth formed a bitter smirk. "My job? I wouldn't call it a job. I answered questions every day for more than a month. I sat in various stuffy little rooms or drafty offices, and I answered their questions. There were also some examinations, blood work, CT scans, that sort of thing." Her eyes shone, and a tremor had crept into her voice. "But mostly, it was just questions." I had caused her discomfort, as surely as a gunshot causes an avalanche. Though the mountainside may have been unstable before I fired the shot, the responsibility was still mine. I didn't want to cause her more distress, but I had to know. "What was it the commission hoped to learn from you?" My voice failed to express the regret I felt at pursuing this course. "Think of a robot," she said, not looking at me. "A robot? I don't know what you..." "What color is it?" she snapped. "Silver, bronze, matte black, green like a copper patina, gray like primer paint. Envision a color, quickly." "White," I said, and only after I said it did I realize that I had still been thinking about ice-capped mountains. The frog shifted in my hands. Loath to hurt it, I loosened my grasp. "Don't tell me about the robot," she said. "Just think it." She instructed me to think of the robot's size, its shape, its texture. She told me not to dwell on these features, but to lock on to the first coherent thing that entered my head. It was the sort of thought exercise that Master Tenzin might have led me through. Finally, she asked me how it moved, and I knew the answer immediately. The frog was still cold and smooth, but it was a different kind of cold, a different kind of smooth. I released it on the ground. White as ice, it took a hop, and then another, its servos whirring as it made quick leaps toward the gutter. When it leaped again, the woman rushed forward and caught it in her purse. "I made a robot," I said, astonished.
"Did you?
Are you sure?"
"You made the robot?"
"Who made the robot is a question best left for philosophers." She made a dismissive gesture with her hand, and I tried not to feel insulted. "The question is, how do we stop it?" From within her purse, the robot frog croaked. There was a bit of low-fidelity 8-bit compression hiss behind the sound.
"Why is it necessary to stop it? You said yourself that the robots are more an annoyance than a danger. I think they're beautiful in a way.
Crypto-phenomena, the secret weather of the world. It's the song changing key. It's how nature turns the page on the book we've all been reading too long. It's the Tower of Babylon collapsing, forcing us to learn new languages, to adapt to new patterns, to better ourselves. When nature gives us something strange to deal with, we're forced to evolve." I'd grown excited again, breathless.
"I'm thankful for the robots," I concluded lamely. "I think they're going to transform us."
"Listen," she said, waving her hands as if dispelling a foul stink. "That's fine. That's fine as long as the robots are just funny jalopies or toy frogs or even insulting barber poles. But I'm starting to think of bad robots." Her shoulders fell in extreme fatigue, perhaps even despair. She took both my hands in hers. "I'm starting to think of robots that scare me."
"Ah," I said, staring down at her hands. "I can see how that might be a problem. Some people are panicking, especially as the robots spread throughout the country. I guess if enough people start to think about scary robots..."
"It doesn't take enough people," she said. "It just takes me."
"But my thoughts changed the frog just then."
"Did they?" she said quietly. "Did I? I don't know. But the robots don't change. They don't appear when I'm not around. I know that. They aren't born from nothing, from, I don't know, a robogenesis. It has something to do with me."
I recalled Master Tenzin's warning that madness and enlightenment were separated by a membrane as thick as an ox's hair, and his caution that discovering one impossible thing did not automatically prove that all impossible things were true. Someone living every day in the company of robots might come to believe herself the center of the new metallic universe, even if it wasn't true. But then, just a moment ago, I'd felt a tiny frog transform into a machine in my very hands. I should treat her statement as truth and see what I could learn. Even the wrong path can lead to a place of beauty, after all. And she did smell quite marvelous. If you are somehow related to the robots, I said slowly, then I understand why you were on the mayor's commission and why they might want to ask you a lot of questions, probably very difficult questions. Even harder than what's the sound of one hand clapping, she said wryly. But what I don't understand is why they let you quit. And why I hadn't heard of her when I'd had access to every piece of intelligence about the robots, but there was no reason to scare her with that kind of spook talk. She let go of my hands and folded them in her lap. Her bag croaked, then made a sound like whirring servos. The frog bot was growling restless. She looked down at the shards of glass from the broken Doombot. I don't know why I trust you, she said. Maybe because somebody who talks in parables and koans wouldn't bother to lie when they can be confusing enough just telling the truth. They didn't let me off the commission. I escaped. They looked for me, but they couldn't find me. Then they stopped looking because they forgot about me. They forgot about me retroactively. Everyone did. My presence on the commission was edited out of existence. Even the videotapes of our sessions changed. Consensual reality underwent a statutory rape. I nodded, but I was thinking, paranoia, conspiracy theory, delusions of grandeur. She sighed. You don't believe me. Listen, you asked me to tell you about the first day the robots came. I said you should ask someone else because everyone remembers that, and everyone does, but I don't remember what everyone else remembers. What they remember is something like a golden mushroom growing up from the ground in the middle of Hollywood Boulevard, something like a closed bulb that opened up into a flower with fractal edges, and then the robots came out, trundling, flapping, hopping, rolling. Some of the robots opened up their own little hatches or chutes or tubes, and other smaller robots came out of their bodies and skittered into the alleys and side streets, and then other robots began dismantling the mushroom thing and running off carrying the pieces with them. There was nothing left behind in the street except a big pothole. People clapped. They thought it was publicity for a movie, some sci-fi spectacular, but then there were more robots and more, and we all realized, you know all this, right?
Sure. I'd read the same story, with countless variations in the Pentagon's files.
Of course. Everyone knows it. Except it's not what happened. The golden mushroom opened, and there was only one robot inside it, 8 feet tall, shaped almost like a person, her body shining white as ice with fingers of transparent crystal and eyes of cobalt glass. She spoke to the crowd. She told them why she'd come and what she wanted to do and what they all had to do. And then she opened a hinged door in her chest where the heart would be on a person, and tiny robots poured out, carrying pieces of bigger robots and assembling them. They had tools too, and they passed them out to people in the crowd. Everyone helped build the robots. Everyone understood why they were doing it. She was crying now, her head bent, tears dripping onto her hands and her purse in her lap. What did they understand? I asked, and in a way, it was the same question I'd been asking myself for years. I wanted to understand too.
I don't remember, she said. Voice hollow, almost mechanical. That's one of the things that changed when I ran away from the commission. When I changed.
Changed how? You like parables, but I'm not good at those, I don't think. Maybe I used to be. I used to be different. I think I should just show you. You see what I am. You should see something of what I used to be. She lifted her head and looked at me. Her eyes were made of cobalt glass, and her fingers, when she touched my hand, were heavy crystal, transparent. Nothing else about her had changed. Everything about everything else had changed. The ground beneath my feet, black glass threaded with silver wires. The shops and office buildings around me, big blocks that looked like gutted radios hung with jungles of striped cables, capacitors the size of hot water heaters, blobs of solder you'd have to carry with both hands. The sky over my head, the dull silver of a well-spent coin. On the sidewalk there were no people, at least not people I'd come to recognize as people. There were figures of glass and figures of bronze and figures of cobbled together cell phones and computer peripherals and sprung audio tapes and pistons and hydraulic limbs. The people moved about with their shopping bags and purses and briefcases, oblivious to the miracles that they'd just become. I held my own hand before my face. The hairs on my knuckles glinted silver. Tiny lights blinked beneath my translucent plastic fingernails. And now, I believed. I believed this woman was what I'd hoped, and my heart soared with joy, my mission so close to completion. Mixed with those feelings, though, was a spiraling sense of panic. I had prepared all my life for a moment like this, but I was still a man of a world in which the rules of gravity and electromagnetism and temporal mechanics could be counted on to apply. Hardwired into my brain was the notion that reality ought not be excessively elastic.
"Can you change things back?"
I asked. On the verge of hyperventilation, her chest rose and fell heavily.
"I don't know." "It's okay if you can't,"
I assured her, trying to assure myself at the same time.
"But if you can, it would be very interesting to me."
She gathered herself, eyes closed. Her glass hand was cold in my grip. I shut my eyes, too.
"Okay,"
she said after a moment. "Okay. How's that?" Something smashed on the ground near my feet. It was an oblong blob, red with rust, about the size of two joined fists. Impact had cracked it open, revealing gears and wires and tubes. Seconds later, another hit the ground a few yards away, and then another closer by. They were coming down more steadily now, one every several seconds. Around us, people, and they were people again, ran for the cover of doorways. It was raining mechanical hearts. But given the presence of the Los Angeles robots, it didn't seem like an impossible situation. The girl once more looked like herself. Flesh and freckles and brown eyes. Or I should say, she looked like herself in this aspect of the world. Gently I drew her to me, held her close, the clean citrus smell of her hair filling my mind with unproductive thoughts. "You are so, so beautiful," I murmured in her ear. "You are perhaps the most beautiful woman I have ever known. You are an incredibly beautiful reweaver." Abruptly, she pulled back from me. It felt as though someone had yanked my own heart out without anesthesia.
"I'm a what?" she said. "And no parables or koans or any of that Bodhi tree crap. Just tell me."
Hearts continued to fall about us. I winced. For what better way to let her know what she was and how I had come to be with her today, now on this street, ready to claim possession of this miracle, than the tale of the sea cow and the concubine? But maybe she was right. Perhaps now was not the time. I cleared my throat. "I told you of the man in the market who created the kingdom of frogs. A man who shaped the world with only the tools of his thoughts. Such people have always existed and always will. They bring the impossible into the world. Some are only slightly gifted, and they bring down rains of blood and whirlwinds of fish. In their wake, bulls speak with human tongues. People burst into flames. These reweavers of the world are often oblivious to the influence they have on things around them. But then, There are men like my teacher, Master Tenzin. He knew what he was, what he could do, and he understood the nightmares he could unleash upon the world if he didn't discipline his mind and learn to calm his own heart. So near the high ceiling of the world, he created a small refuge for himself, a place to meditate, a place to sequester himself from the temptation to reweave the world as he willed. When Westerners came and burned down his temple, he killed them. In a moment of weakness, he drew a line in the ash and brought the mountain down upon them. There were witnesses, of course, Sherpa guides from the village below. One of them understood the potential in what he'd just seen. He understood its worth, and he knew there were people who would pay well for the information. So he contacted the United States government and told them of the incredible weapon living amidst charred rubble on the side of the mountain. The Americans sent some of their best men, but they never found Master Tenzin. But decades later, they finally did catch up with his apprentice. They caught up with me. The girl stared.
"And you're one of us?" she asked. "Like your Master Tenzin, like me."
I barked a laugh. Does one confuse an apostle with Jesus? Does one credit an elf with being Santa Claus? Oh no, nothing like that, I said. I'm a mere student, a researcher, an observer. I have studied the secret weather of the world as well as those who craft it. I came to Los Angeles to learn about the robots, and I have found so much more. I dared to touch her cheek, just brushing it with my fingertips. Instead, I have found you. Her expression grew hard, hostile. Those warm brown eyes darkened, and I felt a pang of fear. Only a fool would wish to make a reweaver angry. I withdrew my hand.
"And now that you've discovered me," she said, "what's your plan?"
"My plan?"
"I assume once the Americans found you, they decided to exploit your expertise?"
Reluctantly, I nodded.
"What am I to you, then? A weapon? Something to transform the arsenals of the government's rivals to sea cucumbers?"
No, nothing like that."
"Or will you keep me for yourself, like a genie in a bottle, a magical woman who grants your fondest wishes and wears a halter top? Will you use me like an engine and ride to power on my back? What am I to you?"
"You are the truth," I said. "You are a new truth, and you drive actuality. By coming to understand you, I will come to understand everything. I am a student. You are the master I have always wanted, and I think I love you."
My voice broke as I said these things. She looked away for several long moments, as if going into a completely internal world, which was possible for her in more than one sense. When she turned back to me, I couldn't read her expression. Then, suddenly, she pulled my face close to hers and kissed me in a way that reversed the Earth's rotation. It was like falling, and the sensation was beautiful and strange and impossible, and no matter what else happens to me or to the world around me, I will never forget that feeling. It was as close to enlightenment as I have ever gotten. I am almost certain it is as close as I will ever get. I kept my eyes closed, holding on to the sensation.
"I have nothing to teach you," she said, gently, but with finality.
"And I won't be studied."
When I opened my eyes, she was gone. I caught a glimpse of motion in my peripheral vision, something small hopping into the gutter. But what it was, I never knew. I stood alone in the street. All around me, hundreds of hearts fell, crashing and shattering to the ground. On a late afternoon, I sat at an outdoor cafe in Santa Monica, sipping a caramel macchiato and dwelling on the thoughts that tangled in the back of my mind, trying to tease out the essential from the mess of the peripheral. I remembered a world transformed, occupied by robots and frogs and a beautiful strange girl or goddess whose name I never learned.
Lately, my dreams were like a memory from earliest childhood, flashes of an alien world more than half hidden, something longed for that dances outside the reach of one's grasp. A golden butterfly, beautiful and coveted, but perhaps best left uncaptured. Yes, things happened the way I remembered them. But, yes, they also happened differently. The world contained robots that shouldn't function. It contained hearts that fall from the sky and frogs with wings and buildings bedecked with living circuitry. And yet it was also true that the world contained none of those things. Out on the boulevard, mermen pulled an opalescent whale through traffic, their scaled muscles containing the gold of the sinking sun. Pygmy dolphins rode the whale's wake, occasionally leaping into the air and singing snatches of a Doors tune. Love Her Madly, I think. It was a perfect Los Angeles postcard moment, but on this day its charms were wasted on me. Somewhere, somehow, I had touched a world much more interesting than the pretty but prosaic scene visible from my sidewalk bistro chair. I wondered if I'd ever find it again. Draining the last of my drink, I stood and set out to wave down a passenger squid. It was time to start looking and learning again. That was my job. This recording was produced by Telltale Weekly for Escape Pod.
And that was our story. I've got nothing to say to it except wow. If you like this story, please tell your friends about it. And check out Telltale Weekly for more great readings. So, I was talking in the intro about Child's Play, and I said you could help me support them. Here's the deal. We've just put up a link to a listener survey on our website, escapepod.org, and we'd love for you to take 5 minutes and fill it out. It's a canned third-party podcast survey to give us a sense of who's listening to the show and what you like about it. The folks who wrote it were obviously geared toward marketing demographics, but I assure you we're not doing this for ad money. That's not our direction. We're still going non-profit. We might, however, seek out public arts grants or NPR-style sponsorship, and this information would help us with that too. If you find any of the questions annoying or irrelevant, just skip them. Ordinarily, we try to give out bribes for this sort of thing, but this one's run by a third party, and it's all anonymous, so we've got no way of knowing who filled it out. But we do get a total count, so here's what I'll offer. I'm planning to give money to Child's Play anyway. But for every one of you who fills out the survey in the next 2 weeks, i.e. before Christmas, I'll give another dollar. Up to, say, $300. This is my own personal cash I'm talking about, not Escape Pod's money. So if a little joy to a hospitalized child is worth 5 minutes of your time, this should be a no-brainer. And you help us out, too. Again, the link's at escapepod.org. And thanks. We've had a ton of book reviews come in the last couple of weeks, and that's fantastic. If you want to add yours too, the number is 206-666-EPOD. We've also had some more promos, and we really dig those too. But I still say there isn't time to do both in this back end, so we're going to start alternating. Book review 1 week, promo the next. This way, if you submitted one or the other to us, we will get to them. Just be patient. To be fair, I should tell you that we reserve the right to only play promos for podcasts we think our audience might like. So if your promo doesn't get played, it's nothing personal. We will, however, try to play every book review we get, unless it's totally outside the bounds of taste or sanity. Now, just to be even more confusing, this week's entry is sort of an un-promo. It's to settle a debt of honor with Salim Fadli, who can make a legitimate claim to being our number one fan. He's blogged about us fervently and extensively. He's written reviews in various places saying things like, "If a cure for cancer is found, this podcast will be responsible." And he told Cory Doctorow about us, which makes him responsible for both our being boing-boinged and for next week's story. Salim's been trying for months to bring a couple of other podcasts to my attention from the Resonance FM radio station in London. One of them was called The Hooting Yard by Frank Key. I finally listened to it, and I slapped myself for not listening before. It's a series of dry, utterly bizarre writings and musings, and I found it hilarious. I don't have a promo for it, so here's an excerpt.
Some say Blodgett conceived his fiendish X-ray plot as revenge against a world that laughed at him because he was a short man. but they are wrong. Blodgett was not of diminutive stature. He was actually somewhere between 6 and 7 feet tall, although it's hard to be precise because he was resistant to tape measures. They would become knotted or twisted, or indeed simply burst into inexplicable flames when Blodgett was near. At a snap of his fingers, similar devices, such as rulers or yardsticks, would crumble to sawdust if they were wooden, or just dust if made of some other substance. Remember that Blodgett was a frightening, frightening man.
If you want more of that, the link's on our website. I'm really running long this time, so please donate, if not to us, then to Child's Play. This podcast is Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives. Everything else is reserved by the authors. Music is by Daikaiju, bringing out the inner robot in all of us. Thanks for listening, and until next week...